it's about more than architecture. It's about more than buildings. It's about more than boulevards. It's actually about the experience through the people that live and have a stake in those places.
Interested in the future of cities as the notion of what the individual can change? What do you think about integrated approaches? How can we save character but create inclusion? Stay tuned for answers from Amir Hussain.
What is the future for cities? Do you want to learn more about them? Do you want to know how others think about them? Do you want to be part of the conversation? Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview Amir Hussain, founder and CEO of IMATECH. We will talk about his vision for the future of cities, the city as a place serving needs, the real estate bubble, integration, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. As founder CEO of IMATECH, Amir Hussain has developed data-led solutions which enhance place and asset-based uplift using ESG benchmarking systems. Amir's personal experience of living within a polarized and disadvantaged community forms a strong understanding of challenging places. Amir is a regular contributor to national and regional policy debates, as well as leading objective discussions about exclusion and polarization. As a partner in solutions-driven corporate fund, ONG Capital, Amir brings a strong understanding of commercial deliverability using transformative large-scale projects, particularly in Tier 2 places. And with that, Amir, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I highly appreciate your appearance on the podcast. Before we jump into the usual questions, please, Amir, explain how you came to be here and how you came to be interested and invested in the future of cities.
I think that's really important to me because it's really emanated from my lived experience. So when I've grown up in a place that has been, I would say, excluded, disadvantaged, ethnically polarized, that has shaped my understanding of the world. And I've grown up in a city which has had a lot of economic decline. It was a former great industrial city, and it's seen a level of turmoil and a level of change that has had really deep-rooted sort of factors and implications for me. Everything from identity and pride and inclusion and a sense of being part of something that you are looking towards a future, hopefully for, is kind of skewed when you're in a place that doesn't reflect those things. When I've grown up, got into work, got into architecture as a career, got into thought leadership areas around boards and regional organizations that were involved in strategically planning places, I always carried that viewpoint with me. And it was something that manifested itself very clearly to me when I joined the LEP board for the Leeds City region, which is a social and economic uplifting body for the whole of this region. And it turned out that when I joined in 2017, they'd given around £40 million in grant funding to help businesses to become more technologically advanced, more productive, more economically active, which is fantastic, except for the fact that nobody I knew in my world had ever even heard of the LEP. So in other words, these kinds of initiatives were essentially just fueling the accelerated growth of one side of society that was enabling them to get even better, which is great, but it was leaving other people behind and actually increasing the divide between the people that are successful and the ones that are not. And very often, my view of the world emanates from those people who are not included. And how do we expose opportunity to them and how do we include them in the strategic aspirations of places?
I appreciate very much how your view on the world is rooted in your background, but you don't seem negative or sour because of your experiences.
Yeah, I actually consider it an incredible attribute, to be honest. I think that the potential and capacity within the elements of society that may be considered less socioeconomically productive is actually immense. So I come from a Pakistani British heritage. I was born in England, but my parents are from Pakistan. I lived in an area that is 75% Pakistani British, very polarized. But I see the level of entrepreneurship. I see the level of commercial activity that takes place. The amount of initiatives that I see taking place are phenomenal. The kind of sense of community is still very strong. And I would say that there is things that are rooted in that background that I think are worthy of becoming mainstream. And for me, I think the issue is that the system very often doesn't recognize the value that certain sections of the community can provide. I guess as an example, when I first got a mobile phone, you had to have a bank account, you had to be registered on the voters register, you had to have good credit, and then you could have a mobile phone. But then somebody, and I don't know which company it was, but somebody created pay-as-you-go, which essentially was a prepayment system for phones. And that change unlocked a massive financial opportunity within a section of the community that was the least economically successful. And it's my view that can be done on multiple levels, but it's the fact that people don't understand the dynamics at that level that means that those opportunities are lost.
How does this manifest for you in cities? What does the city mean to you?
The city for me is a place that should serve the needs I have as a human being, as a member of a community, as a member of society, and as somebody who has hopes, aspirations, and wants to learn, wants to thrive, wants to develop. I think the challenge with cities at the moment is around what I would say is the segmentation or the fragmentation or the segregation of different people. And the biggest one is socioeconomic. People are divided according to where they can afford to live and what they can afford to participate in. They are divided across the views of their educational background and attainment. They're divided by their religious identities and their cultural identities. I think that there is not enough merging of different groups of people in order to create more integrated places. And I think that the way that the planning system, certainly in places like the UK, has worked has kind of reinforced that segregation because you have different uses in different places. So you don't have the merging of different people. The other key factor is the issue around the way that the financial system has undermined places and cities. And that's a massive topic in itself, but I think it's another really big impacting factor on places.
Yes, let's not solve the financial system problem right now. I will ask back, however, knowing the benefits of integrated systems, I would like to just also ask you why segregation is bad.
Segregation is detrimental to places because it will leave, or it does leave, certain groups more disadvantaged than others. And eventually, those disadvantaged groups will affect everybody. I've got a particular view about Brexit, and I think that Brexit was driven by a lot of people who felt disenfranchised, who felt disconnected from decision-making, who felt not able to influence things around them. They'd come out of a very severe recession and that whole process of austerity. And I think the manifestation of that was Brexit. And I think that had the earlier things not happened, then it wouldn't have ended up with Brexit, in my opinion. So the thing about the fact that if you ignore marginalized people, it will have an effect on everybody sooner or later. So therefore, I think it's simply not acceptable. It's not palatable. It's not morally right, but it's not economically right, and it's not socially right that they should be excluded. In my view, I think that this doesn't necessarily need to be driven out of an altruistic sense of, well, we must do nice things for people because we want to be nice. I think it's economically valuable to be inclusive. I think it's socially beneficial to be inclusive. And the city that I live in, Bradford, which I've kind of already touched on, is, I would say, very ethnically polarized. But we recently won the bid for the Capital of Culture, City of Culture 2025 in the UK, precisely based on the distinctiveness that is inherent within that community and within different parts of the community being celebrated and being pulled together in a really powerful proposition. And so it could be a really strong enabler for cities of the future to be fulfilling, to be exciting, to be distinctive, to be alternative. And we lose that opportunity if we allow segregation to really take hold.
We discussed your background. We discussed what does the city mean to you. What does the future of cities mean to you?
This is the really important crux of the situation. There's as many things to be concerned about as there are things that you could be potentially hopeful about. I would say that we're facing incredible challenges. We can see the whole situation with demographic changes, migration, aging populations, the environmental sustainability challenges. I would say the lack of leadership in governments and the mobilization of the broadening out of people's sense of activism, if you like, of how they use social media, how they use different ways to communicate their feelings. If I look at it and say, can we change the world? Can we change the whole country? Can we change? I think it's very difficult. And personally, I'm not a politician. I'm not in a leadership position where I can enact big changes across whole districts. And I would say that very often those kinds of approaches, I don't think have worked well. And I think it's much more about how do you enable and empower people to do things at a local level, at a place where they can influence what's around them. How do you get businesses to have a greater sense of purpose within their spheres of influence and within their areas? And the thing about our whole business, our whole technology approach is centered on this. It's centered on how do we bring the understanding of the characteristics of a place through the lens of the opportunities and the challenges so that the way that responses are formulated are done in ways that don't duplicate or displace things that people are doing that are good and instead are kind of targeted at the areas where there are deficits. So I would say that for me, the future is what can I influence? What can I change around me? What's that opportunity? What's the opportunity of our business proposition to enable the private sector to become agents of change? We feel that the overarching issue with government and local authorities, the challenges they're facing, and the constraints they have on their budgets mean that they have very few or little room, in my opinion, to do the kind of things that are necessary to make places really work for the future. However, I think the private sector, the financial services sector, the investment sector, that has got the ability to do things that are transformational. And if I look again at an example in Bradford, there is a new district heat network being put into the city centre, which is going to have the largest, most energy efficient air source heat pump energy centre in the whole of the UK is going to be built here in Bradford. But the interesting thing about this is that this is entirely privately funded. It's entirely a speculative development. They haven't signed everybody up and said, will you do this if we put it in? They're spending £50 million in the first phase, totally speculatively. This is the ability of the private sector to really help, in this case, decarbonize a city without using the council's money, without using the scenarios that require public investment. But what it does take is government policy to say we need to decarbonize our cities. We want to ensure that that happens. There's going to be a deadline by which it has to be achieved. And that's given this private sector organization the confidence to say, if we put the most efficient, the best possible system in and offer it to people, there's no reason why they wouldn't choose our option, because our option will be the best. On that basis, they're so confident that they'll make that investment. I'm connected into funds. I'm connected into a corporate fund as well. So I understand how these financial systems work. And what's really crazy is that the investment sector is essentially drowning in capital that they are struggling to deploy. So they've got so much money, they are struggling to find enough projects that meet the criteria that they have set to enable them to deploy that money. And then on this side of the fence, we've got places that are so starved of cash that nobody can afford to do anything. And so I think that the future needs to be better relationships between the public and the private sector to be able to build the sorts of scenarios and criteria that allows that money to be channeled into these places through entirely commercial propositions, entrepreneurial propositions, not to say, actually, let's do this in Bradford because we feel sorry for them and we'll do this to be nice and we'll do it as charity or as our social value. They're doing it because they are going to make money. That's the approach that I believe. I'm a big private sector champion. So I believe that's the route to achieving better cities in the future.
Are you hopeful about this kind of future, this better collaboration between private and public?
I am hopeful, yes, because one, governments are so starved of cash and councils are so starved of money that I think they've got no choice but to look at other options. They have to start finding things. I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that it hasn't worked well in the past. The private sector has done some not very good things in places, and I would say the public sector has also done some not very good things in places. But if we look, for example, at the decline of city centres, certainly in the UK, that has emanated out of a financial system that basically determines that you need to have big, large corporate businesses occupying your buildings in order to maximize the value of the building. I won't go into all the details, but what that means is that it was quite attractive for developers and investors and asset owners to demolish beautiful Victorian arcades and small shops and buildings, to put in big shopping centers in the 1970s, to put in cars and car ring roads and all of the infrastructure that goes along with that. And those large format retail units basically replicated each other in every single city. So all the cities basically looked the same. They all had the same things. They all had the same. Now, when we had no choice, we just put up with that. But when the internet came along and gave us many more choices, well, actually, we had no need to go into the city centre. We had no need to go to the shops because we can just get it online. So the experience of going into city centres was not particularly pleasant. There was a survey somewhere that I read which said that people would rather do the washing up than do the shopping. This sense around people not wanting to engage in town centres was, I think, a real problem. But if you look now, that model of retail proposition is dead. It doesn't work. And all the city centres have to reinvent themselves. And they're reinventing themselves with art, with culture, with greenery, with activities. They're trying to stimulate city centres as an exciting destination. On the basis of that, I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful that these places will become better. But as I say, the devil's in the detail, and it still has to be done in a way that is inclusive and is responsive to the things that are the characteristics of that place. And so I think that it's about more than architecture. It's about more than buildings. It's about more than boulevards. It's actually about the experience through the people that live and have a stake in those places, feeling empowered and feeling integrated enough to do things that are commercially viable, but then are also things that add to that rich value of place.
I heard this kind of reflection on the CBDs, the central business districts, losing their popularity, losing their value. But the majority of my interviewees connected this to the COVID-19 pandemic. You say that it's way further back because of financial reasons?
Yes. If you look at how buildings get delivered and why somebody chooses to acquire a site, go through the process of designing something, building something. This is driven by the investment sector that needs to invest in assets that create a long-term return. Now, when you have a sector that's only interested in a return on investment, then they will try to create a product that will give them a tenant that will essentially be able to pay the rent for a long period of time. If you're going to spend all this money, the last thing you want to do is take a risk by giving that proposition to some new startup that may go bankrupt in a year's time, may not work, may fail, because you are essentially relying on that long-term income. So what that's done is it's meant that the investments that are going into buildings that are essentially delivering all of these assets are being designed for a particular type of user, a particular type of occupier. And naturally, what happened in city centers is those have always evolved. Something has failed, something new has started, some new things have set, new trends. But what we saw, certainly up until, I would say, the 2000s, before that, was that if you own an asset in a city center, the value of your building is determined by the covenant strength of the tenant. So if you have a large corporate international organization as your tenant, your building is actually worth more than if it's filled with 50 small businesses that have all started up, because you are going to refinance that building. You're essentially going to give that building to a bank and say, I want to borrow money against this building. The bank is going to say, to what extent are we guaranteed that you're going to receive your rent? Because if you don't receive your rent, you're not going to be able to pay us back. So if you put in lots and lots of small businesses in there and half of them fail, that means you can't pay us back. So what that means is that an asset owner would rather leave a building empty than to give it to a new startup or a business that is simply, might be doing something very innovative, very interesting, but it has no covenant strength. If you give a 10-year lease to that company and then tomorrow a big corporate turns up and says, oh, we want your building, you can't give them it because now you've given it to this small business. You now locked in that low value in the building and you can't then bring it up. Now, this is what led to all of the shopping centers and all of the big format retail units being created in city centers. I can tell you about examples where private equity has bought a shopping center, big shopping center in the Midlands, for over £300 million because of the value of all the different businesses that were in that shopping center. So everybody from Debenhams to Marks and Spencers to Woolworths, to all the big names were in that shopping center. So it was generating a very good income. And based on the covenant strength of all these businesses, they paid over £300 million for it. Now, 25 years later, that building has lost, I would say, 90% of all of those big names. And it's actually worth £10 million from over £300 million. Now, that's kind of what's happened on high streets. That's what's happened to shopping centers. They've become extraordinarily devalued. So what this has done is it's said that where you have these kinds of redundant assets, what happens with those? Similar things are happening with the office sector. It turns out that most corporate organizations are only interested in highly sustainable office buildings because they have to do their ESG reporting. They have to demonstrate their commitment to net zero or to climate change. So they are struggling to occupy buildings that don't meet these kinds of thresholds. That's now leaving lots of older buildings, office buildings, redundant. There's not many people that want them. And if they do, it tends to be very small businesses. And again, there isn't the stability there. And when we look at the value economically of the big buildings that then become redundant in areas, that has a really devastating impact on city centers. So hopefully that gives a little bit more insight into kind of the background of the financial system on the impact of cities.
This is fascinating. I've never really thought about it in this way. So thank you very much for your explanation.
Well, it goes very far because it actually determines which places develop and which ones don't. Certainly in the UK, and I think in America, and places that are based on this system. So for that reason, it has very far-reaching consequences.
You mentioned some of them, but what are the three biggest fears or concerns regarding the future of cities for you?
I think number one has to be this idea of greenwashing, where a lot of things are done for optics in terms of being able to tick a box, but don't actually have a real value in terms of creating better places. So I think the sustainability question is still evolving. And I think that it can be seen that places where you have higher levels of socioeconomic activity have got a greater level of capacity to consider these things. And areas which are potentially the most deprived and most disadvantaged, in those areas, it's actually even worse. So if you look at things like access to green space and air quality, it feels like the data that we've looked at shows that in some of the most deprived places and disadvantaged places are the most adversely affected by it. And the areas that are the wealthiest are the ones that actually have those attributes. So that brings me on to my second fear, which is inequality. I think that inequality is a bigger problem than poverty itself. I think that inequality undermines social harmony. And I think that when we look at how different socioeconomic groups are faring from a well-being perspective and from a financial perspective, I think that the implications to different groups becomes quite hard. So if I look again at Bradford as an example, and it's kind of like I say, I use Bradford quite a lot as a benchmark, if you like, but the socioeconomic group that is most excluded and most disadvantaged is actually young white males. And it's surprising that's the case. But if I look at that is within the British Pakistani community, especially amongst women, it's significantly worse than the national average and significantly worse than the Bradford average. So there's different types of things that are causing inequality, which are affecting different people in different ways. But fundamentally, I think it's about something really basic, which is how do people actually interact? And what are the touch points that enable a community to develop? And if you consider the fact that we've lost a lot of assets, it might be the pub or a corner shop or a cafe or a laundrette, these kinds of things that would have been the touch points where people would get to know their neighbours, would get to know each other, those have gone. So how do different people actually get to know each other? Where are the places that they get to know their neighbours? As a society, we're more globally connected than ever before in terms of our social media or WhatsApp or calls and so on. Yet the levels of loneliness and anxiety and depression are all higher than they've ever been in human history. So I think there's a massive rush to technology, which I fully support and believe in, but it's at the expense of the human dimension, I feel. And it's that lack of focus on the core human dimension that I think is going to be one of the biggest challenges. I think the other one is integration. And as somebody who comes from a minority background, I know what it means to feel that there aren't the things that I would want in an area, whether that's to do with my faith and it's about a prayer space, or whether it's about the halal food, or whether it's about just feeling comfortable in a place. That's a lived reality for me. So going to a new place or going to a place where it's the single dominant demographic is white British has an impact on how I feel in that place. But equally, like I mentioned, I live in an area that is 75% British Pakistani. To what extent does somebody who's not British Pakistani feel the same way where I am? And so in other words, it's the difference between polarization and diversity. So when I'm in London, and I spend a lot of time in London, that feels very integrated. It feels very pluralistic. I feel comfortable pretty much everywhere. But in a lot of other places, That's not the case. And what we're doing in our tech business is bringing that information to life. And what that means is that if somebody is putting their corporate headquarters from that location to that location, they should be conscious this is how that location would affect people who may be Jewish or maybe Sikh or maybe Hindu. So how is that location potentially disadvantaging somebody from a minority background? And for me, I feel like that the real prize are holistic, integrated, rich places which have a diverse offering that's very specific and very distinctive to that place that helps to create an environment that people want to live in, want to work in, want to be there. And then if I translate that to the economics, what does that do for rental values? What does that do for void periods? What does that do for a visitor economy? What does that do for crime statistics and insurance values and so on? So in other words, how does that sort of start to have a positive impact? That sort of integration point, I think, is a critical one.
Somehow, I think you are not just talking about the fears and concerns, but also about the opportunities while you are describing the fears.
I'm inherently an optimistic person, and I've got a lot more to be excited about than I have to be depressed about.
That's really good. This might be a hard question. So you mentioned this difference between polarization and diversity. I completely agree that it's good to have diversity. It can be frightening to have polarization. However, it's really interesting that you also say places should keep their identity, which means, for example, for your community, is that you and your community should keep that 75% of British Pakistani cultural heritage and history, which means that a white British person probably would never feel very comfortable in that space. I fear some discrepancy in this description, so please let me know how I'm understanding it wrong.
No, I think you make a good point. You know, the first thing is that these are very sensitive issues. Very few people are comfortable talking about it. And there's been a lot of history. There's been history where people feel victimized, where people feel marginalized, where people feel that they have grievances around this. So there's a long history behind this, which I think we have to acknowledge that there are these broader sensitivities that we have to be conscious of. And many people view this through that lens. Where I see the opportunity in that distinctiveness is the celebration of parts of that culture that would make it valuable to a person who's not from that community. So for example, in Bradford, there is an organization called Women's Zone, which is a community facility for, I would say, largely first generation Asians, so my mother's generation, that sort of older, we call them auntie-gees, you know, my mom's generation. And they run a whole series of things like English classes, or they have fitness classes, and they do all kind of activities for that generation, which is phenomenal. It's fantastic to see. I've had the privilege of being allowed in because they were looking for asking for some architectural advice. But what was really fascinating for me was that every day they produce a curry and a canteen style kind of meal for all the ladies. And I ate there, and I have to say, it's the most authentic, home-cooked kind of curry that you could imagine. And the banter and the way that these ladies interact, and they produce it all themselves, and then they eat it all together. It was phenomenal. But interestingly, 2 minutes down the road from where they are is a big corporate office for one of the big national banks. And I was speaking to their external affairs officer, and he was talking about the challenge they have for recruiting people into this location and into this office and so on, compared to others and compared to other parts of their business. And I was saying to them, have you ever heard of this Women's Zone that's just up the road here? And they were like, no, don't know anything about them. And I was like, you know, they do this meal every single day. I tell you what, if they were to sell that to you at lunchtimes, I think people would love to come to this office and work from this office. Because the thing is that it's a kind of offer that you could only get by going to somebody's house. You can't get that food in a restaurant. So to me, it's a real privilege. Now, in this case, what I see is, and I see this across everything, is that the Women's Zone organization themselves don't recognize the value of the asset that they have. To them, it's just normal. This is just what we do, and it's just our thing, and it's just for us. And I'm saying, look, there's actually a very serious commercial proposition here that you could, if you opened this out and made it public, I think people would really buy into this food offer at lunchtimes. Likewise, to the corporate organization, they don't recognize how having that next door to them could potentially be an advantage for people in that building. What the thing that I think needs to happen is essentially there needs to be almost an interpreter that sort of sits between these two organizations and actually can make the marriages, understands what they're doing that would be attractive to them, understand why they would be attractive to them. They're a charity organization. They need to raise money. They're looking for the next grant and the next grant. Actually, they've got a very sustainable business model just through what they've got. So the thing that I think we've got the opportunity to do is to bring forward things in a way that makes it attractive to the mainstream population that might not be from that community in the first instance. That's the kind of thing that I think needs to happen, where it celebrates the fact that demographic is there, but it positions the offer in a way that makes it attractive to a broader demographic.
That sounds fascinating. What did the two groups say to this kind of collaboration?
It didn't progress, unfortunately. They ended up moving offices, which is a shame, really. And partly that's because, as I said, I think somebody has to invest time and effort in making it happen and making it right and so on. And it was, for me, it was just an idea that I mentioned, but not delivered. It wasn't something that I was engaged in. And I can give you 10 examples like that, of that sort of thing. So I see lots and lots of opportunity, but they're not being leveraged. There's much bigger things that are on a, I would say, citywide and on an international scale that are not being leveraged. So I see it like pretty much everywhere. It's just not something that I'm in a position to influence other than talk about.
It's a shame that it didn't go.
I know. You could have made a film on that. You really could. You know?
Yes. You talked about the fears and opportunities. What are the three biggest strengths for the future of cities?
I think the strengths at the moment, I feel, is that there's a level of density to cities that enable opportunities to work. If I'm looking at technology and I start seeing things like how does that influencing mobility, or how does it facilitate the way that we work in places short term, or maybe work in different places? How does it enable things like cloud kitchens or dark kitchens? How do they enable somebody to get into an entrepreneurial business that otherwise they just couldn't have ever afforded to do? All of these things, I think, are based on having sufficient density of people to make these propositions work. The fact that we have large cities and the fact that we have places that people want to live in and want to be in cities is a big advantage. And it's a big opportunity for us to consider how we facilitate things that might not otherwise happen. My greatest sort of hope is that we kind of move away from what I call one-dimensional buildings. So buildings that are just one thing. So a university is just a university, just for students. A museum is just a museum, just for people that are interested in art. A shopping center is just a place where people go shopping. But actually, what would happen if you merged all three of those? What would happen if you started exposing art to people who were never looking for it, were never expecting to see it whilst they're going shopping? I think airports have done this phenomenally well when you try and get to your gate without going through duty free. And the way that they make you go through duty free is that they're exposing every perfume and everything to you on this journey, whether you have an intention to buy anything or not, but you're exposed to it. And that's probably quite a heavy-handed way of doing it. I think that this idea of how we merge different uses within cities is also going to be really uplifting. I think COVID did accelerate a lot of things that were already happening. I think that a lot of people recognized that because they spent 2 years living just in their homes, they recognized the shortcomings of place. They recognized what wasn't there. It called for a greater sense of quality offering within where you live. The whole concept around 15-minute walkable cities is one that we're a great champion of. But what we believe is that if you try to do that as a big sort of imposition by the government or the state onto people and places and say, this is now defined as a 15-minute and this isn't, and this bit is and this isn't, I think it's going to meet a lot of resistance as it has. And I think it causes a lot of confusion. What our view of this is how does any given stakeholder, anybody with an interest in a place, simply make their 15-minute area better? How do they simply start to? And I think that if you've got density, if you've got people and assets, then these things can really flourish. So I think that the big opportunities for the future of cities comes from the very fact that you have a density of people there. And how do you consolidate the different stakeholders, the different asset owners, the different organizations and people to create a holistic offer within a place?
The fears and the opportunities were around greenwashing and sustainability, inequality, and how creating social harmony would be so much better, and technology, which needs to be focused also on helping humans to connect with each other. And the fourth was integration, because it's really important to create not polarized, but diverse places. Yeah. And the strengths, basically the agglomeration of people and the opportunities which comes from that. And the multifunctional places, how those can open up minds. And that how each and every one of us can create a better city, even if it's just a 15-minute city, and what we can do for that.
Yes.
Amir, you have been very generous with your time. What is your role in establishing the future of cities?
Where shall I start? I've always been an entrepreneur, and I've always been somebody who has wanted to have a business that was going to be solutions driven. And in the last 12 years, I've been running an architecture practice. I would argue that architecture is potentially one of the most powerful ways of influencing what happens in a city. And the experiences of Bradford and where I grew up and where I live and so on, those characteristics are relevant everywhere. I think the idea of integration, the idea of social cohesion, the idea of economic activity and entrepreneurship, I think they're relevant everywhere. So what that means is that we've been working very closely on the front line of these issues and these challenges. And we have a lot of knowledge that we were able to bring to projects everywhere. So that was a very clear role. That evolved about 3 years ago when I created Yemi Tech. And Yemi Tech is a business that has really emanated through my colleagues more than me. So people like Alejandro Quinto and Kushal Saraya and others in my team who had a very strong understanding of the power of data, had a very strong understanding of urban technology and the kinds of things that you could start doing if you could make this information accessible. I just enabled those ideas to come to life in a business. But what we are doing now is enabling big corporate institutions, some of the biggest corporations in the world even, that we are talking to and we are guiding and we are enabling through our technology to do things in a way that have a better impact. And what I'm finding is that the appetite from that sector is immense. It's really encouraging to see the extent to which some of these big global companies are engaging with what we're doing, because it's providing a very powerful component for their impact on places. And as I mentioned right at the beginning, these are the organizations that have got the money. They're the organizations that are actually spending it. They're the ones who have got a vested interest in places for the long term. And to be able to influence what they do so that it is more inclusive, so that they do understand who those small stakeholders are within a community, so that they understand who's being excluded, where there's pockets of polarized communities, and who's on the ground that they might be able to connect into to be able to address that, feels like a really powerful way of being able to influence and improve cities, not just here in the UK, but globally. And we are now looking at projects in the city of Austin, Texas, authorities there, in Dubai, in Saudi, and so on. So there is a real sense of momentum and there's a real sense of excitement. And what we've produced is unique. We've created a social fulfillment scoring tool that allows you to score anywhere to understand its level of social fulfillment. That then allows you to identify what the problems are, enables you to be able to measure your impact, and to also be able to target where you want it to get to. So that then enables us to really channel a sense of uplift in places that doesn't happen in any other way at this moment in time. So I'm really proud of the team, and I'm really proud of what we've produced to help shape cities of the future.
And your work is indeed amazing. I remember when Alejandro showed me some of the tables and maps, and that's just amazing. It's
you
really
need to see it now, so it changed a lot. And we believe that we have got the capacity to create the benchmarking standard for measuring the performance of places from a social perspective. And that doesn't exist at this moment in time. And we have got, I would say, a very sophisticated and very inclusive approach to how we understand cities and play to their strengths. Really exciting going forward.
Thank you so much, Amir, for your time and your work. Please keep up the good work and your optimistic and hopeful attitude. Do you have any closing comments or requests for the audience?
I think that everybody is holding a piece of a jigsaw. We can't see the picture on top of the box. The only way that we really know how to position one piece of a jigsaw with another is through relationships and through actually connecting and actually talking and actually enabling people, especially from groups that you might not ordinarily connect into. And so therefore, I think that we all have a sphere of influence to some degree. It might just be our own house, it's just our two neighbors, but we've all got a sphere of influence. And I think that if we just focus on what we can do individually or through our organizations, let alone what you might be able to do to change the world or to change the whole country or to change the whole society, but just at a micro level, then I think that's the real route to a more sustainable, a more dynamic, and a more deliverable place that we can consider is thriving and flourishing.
Thank you so much, Amir.
Thank you.
It was really interesting to hear from Amir, his marveling on preserving character, but also including outsiders. Not to mention his indication of business as an urban strength. Ellen Donegan talked about how cities influence people's willingness to start businesses in episode 129. You can find out more about Amir online, all the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Amir's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the WTF4Cities.com website where the transcripts and show notes are available. You can also subscribe on the website not to miss any new episodes and leave some feedback. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the future for cities podcast?